before a Nigerian court today. Amina Lawal has been on death row since early last year when an Islamic court in northern Nigeria ruled that she should be stoned to death for bearing a child out of wedlock. Mid last year, she lost an appeal against the death sentence, and today her final appeal went before a higher court. Her case has ignited debate about the application of Islamic law, especially as it relates to the rights of women. Samuel Okoya has this report from northern Nigeria.
Amina Lawal has been on death row since March last year, when an Islamic court in northern Nigeria condemned her to death by stoning after she was found guilty of bearing a child out of wedlock. Amina's attempt to stay alive was dashed when an Islamic appeal court upheld the death sentence. As she heads for a higher appeal court, the traumatized lady says she has resigned herself to her fate.
Whatever happens to anyone happens through the wish of God. No one can do to another what God has not ordained.
Her lawyers, who are mainly women, say if she loses the appeal, they will take her case as far as Nigeria's Supreme Court. If she loses the present appeal, she will be left with only one level of appeal before the Supreme Court. The death sentence has raised questions over the rights of women under Islamic law in northern Nigeria. Islamic law was introduced in the area 4 years ago. Human rights groups say the rights of women are frequently violated under the law. Men are set free for the same offense for which women are condemned to death. Amina Lawal's case is a classic example. While she is on death row, the man that was charged with her for committing adultery was set free. Several women's groups have taken up the struggle for the rights of women like Amina, who have received harsh sentences under Islamic law. One such group is the Women's Rights Advancement and Protection Alternative, RAPA. The group is in the forefront of the struggle to save Amina's life. Head of the group, Saudatu Madi, says the struggle is to stop the harsh sentences handed down on women by judges whose interpretation of the Islamic law is faulty.
All that women groups like mine are doing is to ensure that the law is applied as it is ordained by the Creator. And once that is done, we know quite a number of the things that women may fall pitfall to because of so many other extraneous factors.
Ya Allah, 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 Allah. Ya Allah, 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 Allah. Ya Allah, 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 Allah.
But some hardline Muslim groups strongly support the sentences handed down by the Islamic courts. This includes the Hizbas, a group of vigilante youths who police the people to ensure compliance with the Islamic law. In Funtua, northern Nigeria, where Amina lives, I asked the local Hizba members whether they will take part in stoning her to death if she loses her appeal.
Ana son matasa masu ƙarfi waɗanda za su kasance babu wani kasala a jikinsu dan haka ake kamar irin mu matasa waɗanda
we shall stone her, we shall stone her, was their response. They said stoning her to death is very much in line with Islamic law. Amina Lawal has become the symbol of the conflict between women's rights activists and extreme Muslims like the Hizbas who want her stoned to death. The outcome of her appeal will be crucial for either side. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Funtua, northern Nigeria.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
Oh, yes? This is Quentin Crisp. You're listening to WUSB. Stony Brook.
Okay, get off the phone, Quentin. Yeah, this is WUSB Stony Brook, as he just told you. This is Emmanuel, and I have bad news, good news, and bad news. Bad news is you won't be hearing me tonight, but the good news is you will be hearing Professor Noam Chomsky speaking for the next hour or so in two different recordings, both taped here at the State University of New York at Stony Brook about a month or so ago. And I urge those of you out there who are currently banging your head against the wall to listen to what he has to say, because I find it immensely interesting. In fact, I volunteered to give up this time slot so we could bring his words of wisdom to you who are listening throughout the world right now. So without any further ado, let's take a listen to Professor Noam Chomsky. There are two different pieces here. The first one runs about 20 minutes, and the second one will run about another 70 or so. And we'll be back again next week with an edition of Off the Wall. And now, without any further ado, Professor Noam Chomsky.
There are basically two ways in which you can look at the question of law and war. One is classical. A brief statement of it, if my memory is correct, is from Thucydides, who said that the powerful do what they want and the weak do as they must. Okay, that's one approach. You can put it in polysyllabic rhetoric, but the idea is pretty simple. The other approach is that there's some framework of international law and institutions that the powerful also subordinate themselves to. In the modern period, since the Second World War, that is the United Nations Charter, the foundation of contemporary international law. And in the case of war and peace, it imposes very strict restrictions on the threat or use of force in international affairs. The only relevant exception is if a country is under armed attack. It's allowed to defend itself until the Security Council takes over. That's the famous Article 51. That's the foundation of contemporary international law. It has no enforcement mechanism, so it's meaningless unless the great powers adhere to it, and that means primarily the United States. And as Chad and Jackie pointed out, that's really up to the citizens of the United States. They're the ones that outside forces can't compel the U.S. government to do anything. But the citizens of the United States can, in fact, without limits, and furthermore have. It's worth remembering the successes. Take, say, the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War began just over 40 years ago, 41 years ago. John F. Kennedy and later Lyndon Johnson waged it without any protest whatsoever for 5 or 6 years. By the time the protest began, the main target of the attack, South Vietnam, had been virtually demolished, and the war had spread to the rest of Indochina. By then, we don't know, probably millions of people had been killed. The protest finally did develop quickly, and it was so strong that it was a major factor, in fact, the major factor, in compelling the government to back off. So just to give one example, the Pentagon Papers, you know, it's not declassified, stolen, so therefore much more revealing. Last section of them, which is maybe the most interesting, deals with early 1968. That was after the Tet Offensive, which had made it very clear that the war was going to go on for a long time. The business world turned against it. Lyndon Johnson wanted to send another several 200,000 troops to Vietnam. The Joint Chiefs of Staff objected. They didn't want to send troops because they said they would need them within the United States for civil disorder control. They were afraid the country's going to blow up. Furthermore, the army was collapsing. It's a citizen's army at that time, reflected attitudes at home. They wanted the army out. They wanted the army kept here to control the population. They didn't want to fight the war. That had a big effect. It's one of many things, and it lasted. It's lasted up to the present. So whenever some new administration comes into office, the first thing it does is ask the intelligence agencies to give them a review of the world situation. Usually we find out about it 30 or 40 years later from declassification, if at all. However, in 1989, when the Bush 1 administration came in, someone high up in the government leaked a paragraph of it, an important paragraph. It had to do with what it called wars against much weaker enemies. Notice those are the only enemies that you ever contemplate fighting if you have any intelligence. So wars against much weaker enemies, which means any possible war. And it said that in the case of wars against much weaker enemies, the United States must defeat them decisively and rapidly, because anything else will undermine political support, which is extremely thin. That's a residue of everything that's happened since the 1960s. If you think through the wars of the 1990s up till today, that's exactly what they are. At first, it's necessary to concoct a fantasy of a fantastic enemy about to destroy you or about to conduct genocide or something or other. After frightening the population, you have to move in, defeat them miraculously, rapidly, and decisively. They have to be much weaker. You wouldn't undertake it. Then you can sort of cheer and go off to the next one. But nothing else will work. It's not like the 1960s anymore. The citizenry has changed, and it remains that way. Robert Kagan was quoted as telling you what Americans want, but what he's telling you is what he wants. There's no indication that that's what Americans want. In fact, you want to find out what Americans want, you look at the People poll that was just cited from April. That's the main polling institution in the United States, and in fact, exactly as you heard, I won't repeat, it shows very large majorities in the country after the Iraq War favoring that the UN take the lead in the case of international crises, not the United States. In the case of Iraq, large majorities feel that the United States, the UN, not the US, should be involved in the political and economic reconstruction. And a pretty remarkable 88% believe that the UN, that the United States should have obtained and waited for Security Council authorization before going to war. So what Kagan wants and what Americans want is something quite different. And this is a trajectory that's developed over many years and, as was pointed out, is something to build on. Well, you know, there are sectors of power always who object to that, don't like that outcome. And a dramatic case was last September when the National Security Strategy was released, and it sent plenty of shudders around the world, interesting, including the foreign policy elite within the United States. There was unprecedented dismay over it. It actually was reflected immediately in the main establishment journal, Foreign Affairs, where in October, right afterwards, leading international affairs specialist John Eikenberry accurately described it, I'll quote his words, as a grand strategy that begins with a fundamental commitment to maintaining a unipolar world in which the United States has no peer competitor, a condition which is to be permanent, so that no state or coalition could ever challenge it as a global leader, protector, and enforcer, an approach that renders international norms of self-defense enshrined by Article 51 of the UN Charter almost meaningless. The United States, he says, declares itself to be a revisionist state, seeking to parlay its momentary advantages into a world order in which it runs the show, prompting others to find ways to work around, undermine, contain, and retaliate against U.S. power, leaving the world more dangerous and divided, and the United States less secure. It's incidentally a view widely shared among the conservative foreign policy elite. Before this, a good part of the world, probably a large majority, already regarded the United States as, I'm quoting again from Foreign Affairs, the rogue superpower, considered the single greatest external threat to their societies. Now, that's 99, under Clinton, Samuel Huntington of Harvard. After the National Security Strategy was announced in last September, that is apparently extended to a considerable majority of the world, which seems to regard the United States as the greatest threat to world peace. Now, there are there's no unanimity in the United States among just keeping the foreign policy elites. There are some, very few elsewhere, but some in the United States who think this is fine and welcome what Eikenberry called the imperial grand strategy. One well-known figure, professor of at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, Michael Glennon, a prominent figure in international law in the current issue of Foreign Affairs, remember that's the main establishment journal, he writes that it's time that the whole apparatus of international law and the UN Charter should be recognized to be what he calls hot air and dismissed as irrelevant. As he's explained in books and articles, the enlightened states have to take responsibility to run the world by force if necessary, and the leader of the enlightened states is the United States. Apparently that's true by definition. No argument or evidence is suggested, as if it's kind of, you know, like an error of logic to try to provide argument that an evidence that 2 + 2 = 4 or something like that. It's just kind of like a necessary truth. The leader of the self-declared enlightened states is the United States, and it should rule the world by force. There are others who argue a little more narrowly. The May issue of another major journal, Current History, is an article saying that they're arguing that there should be what the author calls a terrorism exception to Article 51, which permits anticipatory self-defense, meaning permits the United States to act in anticipatory self-defense in violation of Article 51. Again, notice that that's restricted to the United States, and maybe its clients inherit the right, but nobody else. So it's universally accepted that those who regard the United States as the single greatest external threat to their societies, they don't have the right to anticipatory self-defense. On that, there's unanimity. In fact, countries that are under attack by the United States, direct attack, don't even have the right of retaliation. That's true even if the United States is ordered to terminate the attack by the highest international authorities, the World Court and the Security Council, and reacts to those orders by escalating the war. They still don't have the right of retaliation, certainly not anticipatory self-defense. So that's unique to the United States, this right. Furthermore, none of these topics are ever discussed. That's even more dramatic in any of the literature on Article 51 and its possible exceptions. All of that leads a rational person to the conclusion that nothing that is written about these topics can be taken seriously. And there's a mass of stuff. You just have to, unless, of course, you believe that you believe in the rule of force. If you believe in the rule of force, there's no point in the discussions. Guys with the guns do what they want. And that includes, incidentally, our discussion today. If you believe in the rule of force, there's no point in any of this. But apparently almost nobody disagrees. You can investigate that yourself. I won't go through it by just asking how often these truisms can even be mentioned in the massive discussion about these topics in the last years. Well, this new doctrine last September is often called preemptive, but that's a mistake, as has been pointed out repeatedly. Preemptive war could, with a little stretch, fall under Article 51. Preemptive war means a reaction against ongoing or imminent attack before it actually takes place, but when it's obviously taking place. So, you know, shooting, you see planes flying across the Atlantic, planning to bomb New York, you can shoot them down under the exception of preemptive war. But this is what was declared last September is nothing like that. Sometimes it's called preventive war, which is more accurate, but even that's incorrect. There was nothing prevented by the first test case of the new doctrine, the war in Iraq. There was a pretense that the reason was that it was preventive because of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. That was pretty hard to take seriously before, and it's by now been pretty much abandoned, so we don't have to argue about it. There's a new doctrine, a new version, according to high officials, which modifies, extends the national security strategy, states that the United States can attack a country that is hostile and has the intention and ability to produce weapons of mass destruction. Okay, everybody just about has the ability, like the SUNY biology and chemistry labs have the ability, in fact, so does the high school here, I suppose, have the ability to produce chemical and biological weapons. Intention is in the eye of the beholder. So that means that the United States has the right to attack anyone it likes without offering any reason. It's not so easy to find precedents for that stand, at least as official doctrine. There are some examples we might not like to think about, but let's put them aside. Keeping just to the United States, there are a few precedents, and it's worth paying some attention to them. A very important one was formulated exactly 40 years ago by Dean Acheson, respected elder statesman, leading senior advisor to the Kennedy administration. He gave a talk to the American Society of International Law in which he instructed them, quoting him, that no legal issue arises when the United States responds to a challenge to its power, position, and prestige. Okay. Notice that that actually goes beyond the national security doctrine of last September, and this is from the opposite end of the political spectrum. This is from the extreme liberal end of the political spectrum. This was right after the missile crisis in Cuba, which resulted directly from a U.S. international terrorist campaign aimed at what's now called regime change. Terrorism was renewed right after the crisis, but of course that doesn't give Cuba the right for anticipatory self-defense. And what Acheson was saying is international law is irrelevant to all of this, because the U.S. is responding to a challenge to its power, position, and prestige, so it doesn't matter what international law says. Well, take another case, shifting to the opposite extreme of the political spectrum. In 1985, the legal advisor to the State Department of the Reagan administration, notice that that's essentially the current government, virtually the same, informed the country publicly that the United States is not subject to the authority of the World Court, which it rejected, and his reasons were very simply that many countries do not agree with us, and therefore we must reserve to ourselves the right to determine what falls within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States. The case in question was an international terrorist attack against Nicaragua, which the court ordered the U.S. to terminate, and it responded by escalating it with bipartisan support. Well, you know, that reveals the breadth of the political spectrum in the mainstream. But these declarations, and there are others, are crucially different from the national security strategy of last September and its recent expansion for two important reasons. One is they didn't formulate official policy. They only described it, which is different. And second, they're virtually unknown, although they're public, and at least in my opinion, in a society that took its legacy of freedom seriously, they'd be known to everybody and taught in schools. The national security strategy is quite different. It is a statement of official policy, and every effort is made to ensure that it is well known. It's loudly proclaimed, and it's understood that the war in Iraq was just a test. It was, as the New York Times put it, the petri dish for the new security strategy, which is the reason for the overwhelming opposition, the main reason. Well, there are earlier precedents. You've just won. The first one I know of in the United States is in the early years of World War II. This is before the United States entered the war. High-level planners were meeting. They were considering what would happen in the post-war world. And they concluded, this is the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations, that the United States in the post-war world should seek to hold unquestioned power, acting to ensure limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by states that interfere with U.S. intentions. They also recognize that the foremost requirement to secure these ends is the rapid fulfillment of a program of complete rearmament, then as today a central component of what they called an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy for the United States, with no exercise of sovereignty by anyone. Now, at that time, ambitions were limited to what they called the non-German world. This was the early period of the war, and they assumed Germany survive with power and somewhere, and the U.S. would take over the rest. And what they called a grand area, which was to include the Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, and the Far East. These are the principles for that. Later, when Russia beat back the Nazi armies, and it became pretty clear that Germany would be defeated, the ambitions were extended to as much of Eurasia as possible, and by now to the whole world, but pretty much the same formulations. Well, again, that was not official policy, although it's pretty close to subsequent operative policy. Right now, we happen to be at a turning point in the history of international law and institutions. Through the last century, there have been very serious efforts coming from citizen action and pressure to create some kind of a framework of international law and institutions that would limit the use of force in international affairs, maybe prevent it. After World War II, it was well understood that this is a prerequisite for human survival, because the means of destruction that had been developed are so enormous that you just can't have major wars. Well, for the first time, the framework is officially being sent to the scrap heap, and with a certain degree of elite support, though it's by no means unanimous. And unless that course is reversed, it's pretty fair to speculate that there may not be any opportunities for discussions like this one in the not-too-distant future.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Noam Chomsky live at Stony Brook, which was taped a couple of weeks ago, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, actually. This is replacing Off the Wall for this Tuesday evening. We'll be back again within a regular edition of the program next Tuesday from 6 to 7. You can also tune in to Off the Hook tomorrow night at 7 o'clock on WBAI. And for those of you on the Internet that remember the good old days of brain damage here on this radio station, we've just put the 1990 editions of that radio program online. You can reach them at www.2600.com/braindamage. And now we're going to play the longer of the two Noam Chomsky pieces that we have. This was taped at the Wang Center about 3 weeks ago to this day. And it's a very interesting discussion about world events and what it all means. And it was received by a very receptive audience. Runs till about 10 minutes after 7. It's Emmanuel Goldstein. I'll see you next week. Meanwhile, take a listen to this.
When one introduces Noam Chomsky, there are typically certain facts that one rehearses. Among these facts are the 40-some-odd books that he's authored or co-authored, the various honorary doctorates at places like Columbia and Cambridge University, the Kyoto Prize in Basic Sciences, which is, I guess, our Nobel Prize, and the famous quote from the New York Times Book Review and so forth. And, of course, one typically rehearses the statistics from the Arts and Humanities Citation Index, which puts Noam as the most cited living author, at least through the period 1980 to 1992, and number 8 on the all-time list, which has him trailing Plato at number 6 and Freud at number 7. But edging out Hegel at number 9 and leaving Cicero in the dust at 10. All this is very impressive, but I think that there are more important things. More important because we all know lots of important academics who are, for lack of better word, jerks. And I'm not going to say this about you. And we all know of great humanitarians who love people in the abstract but don't seem to like individual persons. And I wanted to comment briefly on Noam as a person from the perspective of just one individual who was a very junior and not particularly promising academic when we met and possibly remain not that promising. I met Noam in 1983, and after the first meeting sometime later, I was walking down the hall at MIT, and he just stopped me, asked me how I'm doing, how the dissertation is going. At the time, I was a matriculating grad student at another university. And he asked me to send a copy of my dissertation to him, so I did, not expecting much. But then got back within a week, but I don't know, 20, 30 pages of comments on it, okay? Now, what struck me was that that was more than the sum total of all the comments I got from the rest of my dissertation committee combined. And I know I was a grad student, so I counted them. It's also, I should say, more than all the comments I've made on all my dissertation advisees combined, but that's another story. Well, in addition to that, through the years, Noam has patiently corresponded with me, trying to explain his theory, trying to set me straight philosophically. But in all of this, there was always a personal dimension to it, and concern about me, concern about my career, and so forth. Through the years, he's written zillions of letters of recommendation for me, zillions of letters, you know, and many, many other people that he's taken time out to help. And indeed, bailed lots of people out of trouble. Not just figures like journalists in Turkey, but philosophers at certain schools that get removed from tenure track at certain points in their careers. And Noam has interceded to bail some of them out as well. I recently met a former secretary who'd been a secretary working for Noam at MIT some years ago. And she went on and on about how the man was a saint and how it was such a joy to work for him. And I was thinking about some of the past secretaries that have had to work with me. And so the most important thing that Noam has taught me is that no matter how smart you are and how many responsibilities you have, it's still possible to be a good person, a good colleague, and to be responsible to your students and to your junior colleagues. And you just don't have to be a jerk. Now, I was explaining this to Gary Marr, and he said, well, then Peter, why are you such a jerk? And my point is that what Noam showed is that it's possible to not be a jerk. He didn't establish that it was easy. And so what I'd like to do is to thank Noam for his example, even if it may be unattainable, for all the kindness and help he's shown me and many other people through the years. And finally, with just a little bit of application of guilt for his coming to Stony Brook. Thanks.
Pages of notes on your dissertation. That's, I'm impressed. And you're sure most of it wasn't insults? Yeah, okay. Well, let me begin with the most immediate crisis right now in U.S.-Asia relations, and a very dangerous one. Namely, with regard to North Korea. That's the one non-Muslim member of the famous Axis of Evil. The members are the prime potential targets of attack under the national security strategy that was announced last September. As you'll recall, the doctrine declares, in effect, that the United States intends to rule the world by force and will act forcefully, if it chooses, to eliminate any challenge to that domination. The official version defined challenge in terms of possession of weapons of mass destruction, the pretext for the invasion of Iraq. It's become a little difficult to sustain, and the doctrine has accordingly been modified. Now challenge is defined in terms of what's called ability and intention to develop weapons of mass destruction. That suffices for attack. Well, virtually everyone has the ability, including Stony Brook High, assuming it has a chemistry and biology lab, so that reduces to intention. And the implication is that the United States accepts the right, arrogates to itself the right to attack anyone it chooses. Well, these doctrines are not completely new. They considerably extend policies that go all the way back to World War II. The underlying principle was expressed lucidly by Henry Kissinger in an important speech just 30 years ago, 1973. 1973 was the year of Europe, and Kissinger gave an important address called the Year of Europe Address, in which he warned Europeans not to strike an independent course in world affairs. He instructed them that they and others have regional responsibilities within the overall framework of order that is maintained by the United States, global order. And it's now declaring far more expansive ambitions. Well, going back to the axis of evil, North Korea is the most dangerous and the ugliest of the three members, but it's the lowest on the list of targets. So why is that so? Well, to be a target, a country has to meet several conditions. First of all, it has to be defenseless, and secondly, it has to be important. And Iraq qualified on both counts. North Korea, however, fails the first condition. It has a deterrent, massed artillery aimed at Seoul and at U.S. forces in the south. Hence, it cannot be attacked with complete impunity. That will remain a problem unless the Pentagon figures out the way to eliminate the deterrent instantly with precision-guided weapons, maybe tactical nukes. Actually, the problem is being relieved in a way which South Korea regards as rather ominous. The U.S. troops are being withdrawn to south of Seoul, or so the plans are, which could be interpreted in a rather ugly way, which I won't go into. What about the second criterion, importance? Well, North Korea itself is of no importance. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. It's barely surviving. It has no resources to speak of. Nevertheless, it happens to be highly important. Hence, it's a potential target if it can be rendered defenseless. And it's important to understand why. Why it's important. That's a central part of evolving U.S.-Asia relations now. The background reasons are actually well described in a recent study of Northeast Asia by a prestigious task force. It's chaired by Zelig Harrison, who's one of the leading specialists on the region. I'll quote you a couple of comments. Northeast Asia, the task force writes, is now the epicenter of international commerce and technical innovation. Collectively, Japan, South Korea, China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong have constituted the fastest-growing economic region in the world for much of the past two decades, and today account for nearly a third of global GDP, far ahead of the United States. Approximately half of global foreign exchange reserves, are held by Northeast Asian countries. They also account for nearly half of global inbound foreign direct investment, and they're also becoming an increasing source of outbound foreign direct investment in Asia and also to Europe and North America. Russia and China, part of the system, are both rich in natural resources. The economic unification and stability of the two Koreas would be greatly enhanced by the development of gas pipelines that are now projected through North Korea from eastern Siberia and from Sakhalin through the north to the south. Similarly, the projected extension of the Trans-Siberian Railroad through North Korea to the south would transform the peninsula and contribute further to the economic cooperation between Korea and its neighbors. Well, that's the background. North Korea is right in the middle of it. The task force advises the United States to follow the lead of neighboring countries and to seek to negotiate North Korea's step-by-step peaceful integration into the region. But from Washington's point of view, that poses serious problems, conflicts with the Kissinger Doctrine and the much more expansive national security strategy. And Kissinger was by no means the first. Northeast Asia is an integrated region, has rich resources, rapidly developing industrial centers that need the resources, half the world's financial reserves, and so on. It could go off on an independent course, just as continental Europe could with its German-French industrial base. Part of the reason for the intense hostility to Germany and France in recent months, and in fact beyond. Well, that raises the problem that Kissinger outlined, and it's been a significant problem since the United States gained a position of global dominance after World War II. In this case, the problem of potential independence of the Northeast Asian region is an impediment to the peaceful diplomatic settlement of the Korean crisis. Including North Korea. Well, there may be some other impediments. North Korea may have some other memories in mind. Here we have to recall a characteristic difference between the culture of conquerors and victims. Quite typically, the powerful send history to the memory hole, or else they sanitize it for their benefit. The weak don't have that privilege, and they tend to remember history. So it's unlikely, for example, that North Koreans have forgotten what the U.S. Air Force called an object lesson in air power to all the communists in the world, and especially to the communists in North Korea. That lesson, I'm quoting from an enthusiastic report in an official Air Force history, that lesson was delivered a month before the armistice 50 years ago. There were no targets left in the flattened country, so U.S. bombers were sent to destroy irrigation dams. Quoting again, irrigation dams that furnished 75% of the controlled rice supply for North Korea's rice production. The Westerner can little conceive the awesome meaning which the loss of this staple commodity has for the Asian: starvation and slow death, hence the show of rage, the flare of violent tempers, and the avowed threat of reprisal from the Asians, reacting to this reenactment of the kind of crimes that led to death sentences at Nuremberg. One may reasonably wonder whether such memories are in the background, as their desperate leadership plays a kind of nuclear chicken. Well, South Koreans have plenty of memories, too. For example, on Jeju Island, which was the scene of the massacre of maybe 40,000 people in 1948 by forces under the control of the U.S. military, So a large component of the roughly 100,000 killed by the U.S. client regime, U.S. military-backed regime, in South Korea, that's before what we call the Korean War. Perhaps South Koreans also recall more recently Washington's role 15 years ago when the Reagan-Bush administration continued to give strong support to the brutal dictatorships and tried to prevent the democratization of South Korea, which has been a remarkable achievement, as remarkable as its economic development and a kind of model for the world. Well, there could be other memories which have a lot to do with the current situation. For example, memories from 1951. 1951 was the year of the San Francisco Peace Treaty, which formally ended the war in Asia. It's not known very well here, as far as I'm aware. At least I don't ever come across it. The war in Asia, of course, was primarily a war fought by Japan against the countries of Asia. Later, it became a U.S.-led Western war with Japan after Pearl Harbor. And at the San Francisco Treaty, 1951 brought the war to an end. Well, who took part? From Asia, three French colonies in Indochina took part. Apart from them, the only Asian countries that supported the peace treaty were Pakistan and Ceylon, both of them recent British colonies that were remote from the Asian wars. India refused to attend because of the terms of the treaty, in particular the U.S. insistence on retaining Okinawa as a military base, as it still does, over strong protests from Okinawans, which are ignored and largely unknown in the United States. Truman was outraged by India's disobedience, its refusal to attend or support the treaty, just as his heirs are outraged today by the decision of the Turkish government to abide by the wishes of 95% of the population instead of following orders from Washington. It's a crime for which they were berated last week by Paul Wolfowitz, who's depicted as the leader of the crusade to democratize the Middle East, apparently without irony. Truman wrote no less elegantly than Wolfowitz that India must have consulted Uncle Joe and Mousy Dung. Notice that the white man got a name, not just the vulgar outburst. Partly that may be ordinary racism, or perhaps it was because Truman genuinely admired Old Joe, as he called him. Old Joe, Truman said in 1948, was a decent and honest man. Old Joe reminded him of the Missouri boss, Tom Pendergrast, who started him off on his career. Mousy Dung, on the other hand, was a yellow devil. Well, these distinctions just extend wartime propaganda. Anyone my age can recall that the Nazis may have been bad guys, but they merited a certain respect. They were, after all, white, blue-eyed, blonde, at least in the stereotype. Japanese, however, were quite different. They were just vermin to be crushed, that is, once they became enemies. Although before that, the United States was quite tolerant of their depredations in Asia, as long as U.S. business interests were protected. Actually, that went on up till days before Pearl Harbor. And the same factors distinguish Uncle Joe from Mousy Dung. Well, Korea was not even invited to the San Francisco Peace Conference, nor Taiwan, which was regarded as China then by the United States. Korea, Taiwan, and China were the primary victims of Japanese fascism and its predecessors. Quoting a Japanese scholar, Japan's racist wartime ideology, which had propelled atrocities against Asian soldiers and civilians alike, escaped scrutiny and condemnation under the U.S. military occupation and also the peace treaty. Koreans and Chinese received no reparations from Japan, and Secretary of State Dulles personally intervene to ensure that there would be no reparations for Filipinos. He condemned the Filipinos for what he called their emotional prejudices, which kept them from comprehending that they would have no relief for the torture that they endured. There were Japanese reparations, namely to the United States and to other Western colonial powers, and reimbursement from Japan to the United States for the cost of the occupation. Japan's liabilities were restricted to the period beginning on December 7, 1941, although, of course, Japan was responsible for far more severe atrocities and aggression before that. However, before that, it was against Asians, so there was no liability under the terms of the occupation and the peace treaty. For its Asian victims, Japan was to pay compensation, namely export of Japanese manufactured products using South Asian resources. That was a central part of the reconstruction of the Asian system within the U.S. global system after the Second World War. These were arrangements. Could you pass me that bottle of water there? Oh, is there one here? Ah, thanks. Yeah. Sorry. I'm talking so much in the last 4 weeks at Stony Brook. Must be a polluted atmosphere. So Japan was to export, the compensation was that Japan would export manufactured products to using Southeast Asian resources. This was a central part of the arrangements that restored to Japan, in effect, the new order in Asia that it had attempted to gain by conquest, and now is restored to it, but under U.S. domination, so it was okay. This was Japan's empire toward the south, as it was described by the head of the State Department planning staff, George Kennan, who helped design these policies. Some Asian victims of Japanese fascism, forced laborers, did bring suit in California against Japanese corporations with subsidiaries in the United States, corporations that were the legal successors of those responsible for the crimes. On the eve of the 50th anniversary of the peace treaty, their suit was dismissed by a California judge on grounds that their claims were barred by the treaty. The State Department had filed a brief in support of the accused Japanese corporations, and relying on the brief, the judge ruled that, I'm quoting him, the San Francisco Peace Treaty had served to sustain U.S. security interests in Asia and to support peace and stability in the region. The Asia historian John Price, one of the very few to have written about these things, described this judgment as one of the more abysmal moments of denial, pointing out that at least 10 million Asians had been killed in wars while Asia was an oasis of peace and stability. Elite opinion concerning these wars ranges, as it usually does, over a spectrum from doves to hawks. So just keeping to the Indochina wars and to recent ex-presidents, Carter and Clinton were doves. Bush, number one, was a moderate, and Reagan was a hawk. Reagan lauded the enterprise as a noble cause for which the victims of the aggression were completely to blame, along with Russia and China. Bush, number one, the moderate, informed the Vietnamese that although we could never forgive them for the crimes they committed against us, we would nevertheless be gracious and will not seek retribution for the past, he said, as long as they dedicate themselves with sufficient zeal to the sole moral issue that remains after U.S. aggression that led to the death of maybe 4 to 5 million people and the destruction of three countries. The sole moral issue, of course, is the fate of American MIAs. Carter, on the other hand, at the other extreme, the dove, informed the press that we owe the Vietnamese no debt because the destruction was mutual, his words. Perfectly obvious from a walk through Stony Brook and Quang Nai province. Clinton was still more forthcoming. True, he did force Vietnam to assume the debt owed to Washington by the client regime that Washington had established as the local base for its war against the internal aggression of the South Vietnamese against America. That's Adlai Stevenson's phrase. But Clinton magnanimously forgave part of that debt. So there is a spectrum of opinion from doves to hawks. The spectrum of elite intellectual opinion is barely wider, although it's interesting that the general population has been radically different for 35 years. Since 1969, a large majority has consistently held that the war was fundamentally wrong and immoral, not a mistake. It's a view that's almost never voiced in respectable circles, meaning everyone made it up for themselves. Nevertheless, the usual reconstruction of history has succeeded with the public. In the only study of the matter that I know, an academic study at the University of Massachusetts, the Policy Institute there, it asked people to estimate the number of Vietnamese deaths. And the median judgment was about 100,000. That's about 5% of the official U.S. figure and a much smaller percentage, very likely, of the actual figure. As far as I'm aware, these shocking reports received no comment or discussion. The authors of the academic study suggest that we might think there was some problem in Germany if the median estimate of Holocaust deaths were 300,000. But such judgments are never applied by the victorious and the powerful to themselves. And if they're ever mentioned, they elicit outrage and quite impressive tantrums. Well, going back to Clinton's magnanimous gesture, it was explicitly modeled on a 1908 program that returned to China a portion of the indemnity that it had been forced to pay for rebelling against its foreign masters. That's the Boxer Rebellion. And there are earlier precedents. Haiti's liberation from French rule in 1804 shocked civilized opinion, which was concerned that the virus of liberation might spread from the first free country in the Western Hemisphere. For obvious reasons, the danger was particularly acute in the United States, which took the lead in isolating the criminal state. It relented only in 1862 when destinations were being sought for freed slaves. Liberia was recognized in the same year for the same reasons. In punishment for its crime of liberation, Haiti was compelled by France in 1825 to pay France a huge indemnity, which guaranteed French domination and had a catastrophic effect on the society that France had devastated during its War of Liberation. This had been France's richest colony, the source of much of France's wealth. But not enough. Haiti had to pay a huge indemnity for the crime of liberation. Half a century before France's punishment of Haiti, for its defiance of the norms of civilized behavior, George Washington set forth on the conquest of the advanced Iroquois civilization in New York. His goal, in his words, was to extirpate them from the country. And so he wrote to Lafayette on July 4, 1779, and also to expand American boundaries westward toward the Mississippi. Conquest of Canada was barred by British force, although there were a few attempts beaten back. The town destroyer, as Washington was known to the indigenous population, completed his mission successfully. The Iroquois were then politely informed that they would have to provide compensation for their treacherous resistance to their liberators. Another Clinton, then governor of New York, informed the defeated tribes, quote him, that considering our losses, the debts we have incurred, and our former friendship, it is reasonable that you make to us a cession of your lands, as will aid us in repairing and discharging the losses and debts we have incurred. Having as little choice as Haitians and Chinese and Vietnamese and many others, in the face of overwhelming force, the Iroquois ceded their territory, only to discover that New York State proceeded at once to violate its solemn treaties, including this one, and to take the rest of the territories through threats and deception and guile. A young American soldier later wrote home, his words, that I feel really guilty as I apply the torch to huts that were homes of content until we ravagers came spreading desolation everywhere, but perhaps in a good cause, he added. Our mission here is ostensibly to destroy, but may it not transpire that we pillagers are carelessly sowing the seeds of empire, so some good could come out of it. And citizens of New York, and for that matter of Massachusetts, continue to benefit from the seeds that were sown, and I'm sure all of this is taught in every elementary school in New York, just as it should be. Well, fact of the matter is that the inheritors of the seeds of empire that were sown in this way, not only in New York State, know very little about any of this, just as they know very little, virtually nothing, about their deeds in Asia. But it's well to remember that the founding fathers who were carrying all this out in the early stages, they were very well aware of what they were doing. Not some, like President Monroe, preferred to believe that, in his words, we'd become in reality their benefactors by expelling the natives from their homes. But others had a somewhat clearer vision. So Secretary of War Knox, for Secretary of War, warned that a future historian may mark the causes of this destruction of the human race in sable colors. John Quincy Adams, who had quite a horrendous record himself, became an outspoken critic of the policies toward the indigenous population well after he left power, described these policies as among the most heinous sins of this nation, for which I believe God will one day bring it to judgment, and he hoped that his belated stand might somehow aid that hapless race of Native Americans, which we are exterminating with such merciless and perfidious cruelty. But his recantation had no effect on the extermination, which continued with full ruthlessness. So little is known about any of this, or at least understood, that the conquerors even proudly name their instruments of destruction after the victims of virtual genocide. Actually, I think the U.S. may be unique among conquerors in this respect. So I suppose that some eyebrows would be raised if the Luftwaffe were to call its lethal attack helicopters a Jew and Gypsy. Although there's no problem here if they're called Black Hawk and Apache. In fact, few would even know what those names signify. So, for example, how many even know that Black Hawk was the leader of the resistance to the conquerors in the 1830s in the Midwest, and after his capture and imprisonment for his crime of resistance, he was paraded in triumph through American cities by the War Department, which had a more honest name in those days. And there's no need to relate what happened to his people. Well, let's go back to the period of the European conquest of much of Asia. According to World Bank estimates, in 1820, the economic distance between the richest and the poorest countries of the world was about 3-1. And that rose to 35-1 by 1950, to 72-1 by 1992. In the mid-18th century, beginning of the conquest, there was apparently no difference in economic level between the more economically advanced centers of Europe and Asia. In fact, in many respects, the Asian countries were probably more advanced than England, so recent scholarship suggests. China and India were major industrial and commercial centers, main ones in the world. East Asia was far ahead of Europe in public health, probably in sophistication of market systems. Life expectancy in Japan was apparently higher than Europe. Europe was trying to catch up in the late 18th century in textiles, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and other manufacturers. It was borrowing from India in ways that are now called piracy and are banned in the international trade agreements that have been imposed by the rich states once they used those methods, crucially the United States, to achieve a level of development. It's now imposed on everyone else. Nobody would have developed if the current World Trade Organization rules were in place. In the 1820s, British engineers were studying Indian steelmaking techniques in order to help English steelmakers close the technological gap with India. It's a recent technical study in the United States. The future Duke of Wellington equipped his troops with Indian artillery for the Napoleonic Wars because they were better than British products. And he also sought to acquire Indian ships for the same reason, but that was barred by Parliament to protect Britain's infant shipping industry. That's how all of British industry developed, protection for and state power for England, forced liberalization for India, and that just generalizes around the world. During the railroad age, India probably had a comparative advantage in locomotive production, but that was rendered inoperative by the British imperial preference system. I remember that this was during the period of enthusiasm for free trade, and it's not an unusual example of the way the concept is applied in practice. Among the countries with large rail networks, India was the only one that failed to industrialize during the railroad era, and it was also the only colony among them, unable to exercise sovereign rights. The difference in industrial development between India and Japan is particularly striking. Quote an Indian economic historian, Daniel Thorner, it simply illustrates the difference in the direction and emphasis between a country running its own affairs and a dependency whose affairs were being managed by an external power. It's rather hard to overlook the fact that the countries that developed were those that retained their sovereignty, Western Europe and its offshoots, and Japan, which resisted colonization, and incidentally, Japan's colonies, which it did develop. Japan was a cruel and brutal conqueror, but unlike the Western imperial powers, it developed its colonies at roughly the same rate as Japan itself. That's what's now Taiwan and Korea, South Korea, all of Korea, which then there was a lull during and after the Second World War, but then it picked up again. So it's same pattern's been continuing. It wasn't until independence that Indian development resumed the course that had been blocked by colonization. On the eve of independence in the mid-1940s, life expectancy in India was about what it had been two centuries earlier. It's doubled since. That gives you a measure of the deaths, the murder caused by the colonization period. In the past half century of independence, there have been no major famines in India. In the last half of the preceding century, under British rule, some 30 million people died in famines, and they continued right until independence. China wasn't conquered until 150 years ago, when Britain forced China to accept British exports. China had not been interested in doing so, and the reason was well understood by British agents in the region. The problem was that Britain's products were not competitive with China's own manufacturers, so they couldn't sell them in the Chinese market. That was actually the problem that Britain had faced in India a century earlier, and there it was overcome by forcing India to liberalize while Britain retained powerful state controls and protection a pattern again that has been replicated for every currently developed country dramatically, the United States. China was finally brought into the civilized world about 150 years ago by the Second Opium War, which Britain fought in order to turn China into a market for British goods. They couldn't sell them anything else, but they could sell them opium, and they forced them to accept it. Incidentally, they also turned it into a nation of drug addicts. The rest of India was conquered at about the same time. That was largely motivated by the need to gain a monopoly of opium production, which almost succeeded, but not quite, because Yankee traders were right behind, along with a few others. This, again, was during the period of enthusiasm about free trade. Britain's narco-trafficking enterprise was quite awesome in scale, I mean, far and away the greatest in history. Its revenue subsidized the colonial regime in India. They sustained the East India Company in its day as the hub of British commerce in the East. Narco-trafficking also enabled Britain to purchase U.S. cotton. Remember, cotton was kind of the counterpart of oil in the 19th century. And the same revenues financed a good part of the costs of the Royal Navy, which protected the empire. One British Governor General commented that the drug addicts in China helped make the extension of British rule in China possible. They also, we can add, made the British rule in India possible, and in fact were a fundamental factor in the Industrial Revolution in England, later elsewhere, and the foundations of modern capitalism. The opium trade was called the poison trade. It had one major competitor, which a recent English-China historian describes. The major competitor was, in his words, what was jocosely known in mercantile circles as the pig trade. He's referring to the people, the pigs, to the conquerors. The Chinese government was unable to protect its citizens after Britain forced it open and basically conquered it, and therefore unlucky Chinese could be kidnapped or shanghaied in the term that entered the language, then shipped to America, which urgently needed them for what amounted to slave labor for a big part of American Industrial Revolution, railroads and so on. Or they could be shipped to British plantations in the West Indies and elsewhere, including women sold to be girl slaves, as they were called. The British demonstrated their reverence for civilization when Lord Elgin's troops, during the Second Opium War, destroyed the Summer Palace in Peking, burning it to the ground after the pillage of its rich artistic treasures. Certain resonance to these barbaric acts today. At the time, they were heartily applauded by the great statesman Lord Palmerston as absolutely necessary, in his words. He was joined by other exemplary figures. The actions owe much to the experience of Lord Elgin's soldiers, quote an English historian today, Lord Elgin's soldiers, who formed their view of inferior races in India during the Indian Mutiny. Indian Mutiny is the term that's used in England for the Indian Rebellion of 1857, which elicited an extraordinary outburst of savagery. We're allowed to do it to them, but they're not allowed to do it to us, a fraction of it. And in fact, the population of several states of India actually declined for the next generation. Well, all of this, of course, it's only the barest sample. All that's been dispatched to the memory hole, apart from corners of scholarship and people who care about it. So one hears very little about any of these things in the current revival of odes to empire and calls to renew its glories. Many here, many in England, for example, Tony Blair's key foreign policy advisor, Robert Cooper, who thoughtfully explains in his words that the need for colonization is as great as it ever was in the 19th century to bring to the rest of the world the principles of order, freedom, and justice which the postmodern societies of the West, to which they're dedicated, those at the wrong end of the guns may have a somewhat different memory and perception of the benefits of the empire, but fortunately we don't hear from them. Well, let me finally turn to the description of Asia's role in the world today, the one that I quoted at the beginning from the Harrison Task Force study. Some historians have suggested, not unrealistically, that the period of European rule over a long, seen over a long stretch, might be seen as a kind of interregnum, that is a break of several centuries in a period of Asian dominance in many spheres. And that concern is very much alive. It's a prospect of deep concern to U.S. planners. The Northeast Asian problem that I mentioned is part of it, and the North Korea issue fits into it. For the Washington neocons, the dominant policymaking group, China is quite openly regarded as the great potential enemy. A good deal of military planning is geared to that contingency, notably missile defense, which is an offensive weapon, part of a first strike capacity that's understood on all sides. The concerns over North Korea and Northeast Asian integration, they fall in the same framework. There have been recent efforts to strengthen India-U.S. strategic relations, and they're partly motivated by the same concerns, along with concerns about controlling the world's largest energy reserves in the Middle East. One of the main reasons why the U.S. always insisted on controlling those since World War II was to have what George Kennan called veto power over others, specifically Japan, in case they ever got out of line. And if they move off in their own directions with their own independent energy resources, that's lost. Part of the reasons that lie behind the current Iraq war. Well, there isn't much point speculating about the future. Human history is not something that we observe from afar, like the motions of the planets or the distant stars. Human history is something that humans create. And that leaves us with some truisms that are almost too obvious to mention. We're uniquely privileged. We enjoy a legacy of freedom and of opportunity that is shared by very few. Privileges confer responsibility. To no slight extent, the shape of the future is in our hands, and I don't think history will look kindly on us if we do not take up that opportunity and responsibility.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You've just been listening to a special edition of Off the Wall, and that was the Noam Chomsky lecture from approximately 3 weeks ago, this Tuesday, I believe, and recorded right over here at the Wong Center at WSB at Stony Brook University. Excuse me. This is Joe C. filling in for Bill Darling here on the Blues Show, and in just a few, we'll be bringing you the best of the blues. But right now, we want you to check out the intro. And thanks for listening to Noam Chomsky. I believe there will be some additional Noam Chomsky lectures being broadcast at WUSB, so stay tuned for that. I'm sure you'll be duly informed.